also, I think it's important because of the irony that's involved in the man who asks the question. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go, because when you consider and when you read through the narrative of Elijah and what happens specifically after this, after the situation on Mount Carmel, you find out that in Elijah's case, who, you know, where he's laying it out in such black and white terms that it's God or Baal, you pick one, you know, as if he has said, I'm here and you're there and you need to be. And then we find out in the very next chapter that coming to that answer is a little more difficult than maybe one would hope, or that we would hope for ourselves even. And so the irony of Elijah being the strong and powerful prophet of God to stand and say, this is how it's going to be, and then we find out in chapter 19 he wavers quite a bit. And coming to that answer that we know is true is not quite as easy as maybe we would think. And so the irony of that is interesting, and we'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute. Even somebody in Elijah's case has that situation, but also because we have an interesting narrative of how God helps Elijah along the way to come to this answer, to sort of hold his hand and bring him through all of this stuff that Elijah gets himself in, and to come out on the other end where Elijah can probably say at the end, God is God, and I'm going to follow him. But it takes him a little while to get there. And so it's an interesting narrative, and it's an interesting story, and I hope that we'll be able to do that. And so I want to examine this question, and I want to ask this question and look at it from the perspective of the three characters that we just mentioned, the perspective of the people who are here up on Mount Carmel, where Elijah comes to the showdown. And I want to think about it in terms of what it means and what we can learn from the people, but also what we can learn from Elijah. And when we get to chapter 19 and what happens after this, what do we learn from Elijah? And yet also, in the end of this that we just mentioned, what is it that we can learn from God and the part that he plays in all of this and what it means for you and what it means for me? So just three ways that we can look at it. Let's think and let's ask the question, how long will you falter between two opinions? What do we learn from the people? I think there's something, and this is probably the most obvious, the easiest application, the thing that is the most, that stands out the most, at least in my opinion, in that Elijah frames the situation here in this dichotomy that it's either this or it's this. It's either God or it's Baal. If this is the case, this is what you should do. If this is the case, this is what you should do. And scholars tell us scholars tell us that during this time, Ahab, not only did Ahab set up the altars to Baal in Samaria and in the other places around the kingdom, but the people had taken those two things, the worship of God and the worship of Baal, and had actually begun to do kind of what Elijah was saying, that they were faltering in between, and that the people had taken the worship of God and the worship of Baal and kind of mixed them together. And so they were doing both of the same things and just considering themselves this was all well and good because we're worshiping God and we're worshiping Baal. We're worshiping Ahab's God and we're worshiping Jezebel's God. And so mixing them all together. And scholars tell us it was an interesting sort of mix of things. And so Elijah wants to help them to see the error in their way and to see the error of that approach to life. In the same vein, in the same idea, the obvious application, at least to me, for us as people, is that all of us, find ourselves sometimes caught in the middle of a devotion to one thing or torn between two competing interests of self and of God or of you know, and you could name the list. Self covers the most, right? Things that I want versus who I should be. Serving myself or serving God. All of us find ourselves with competing interests and sometimes found in the middle, competing rulers for our own lives. Everyone has things in life that pull on us and that try to weigh on our emotions or on our anxieties or pull on us away from the things that we know that we should be right. And they're going to pull us away, things that we know that we should be devoting ourselves to. And it's this reason, and I think it's part of, and we all probably would admit that this happens. It's part of human nature. If it wasn't, Jesus would not have to say things like, I've come. You need to deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. It wouldn't be an encouragement of Jesus to say, you've got to be aware that you're going to have to cut things off that you want if it wasn't something that was common to us. And so for Jesus to say, it's time to deny self and to follow him, it's a big deal. He wouldn't have asked us if it was something that was easy or if it was something that nobody struggled with. It's the reason why he has to say in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6 when he says that nobody can serve two masters. You're either going to love the one and you're going to despise the other, or you're going to be devoted to the one, right? Or hate the one and despise the other and be devoted to the other. You can't stand in the middle. There's no way to stand and worship self and God. There's no way to worship, in Jesus' words, you can't serve God and money or God and mammon, those kind of things. Those are the ideas that comes out immediately. And so it's imperative that we come to the conclusion that Elijah wants the people to come to, that God really is God, and that God really deserves to be followed, not something else, and that standing in the middle, that being the people who falter from one opinion to the other, is not really a place that's desirable to be. And so the obvious application is for us, that we all have those things that pull us. But more interesting to me, and I guess maybe that is meaningful, is to look at Isaiah, or look at Isaiah. I'm going to name all of them before we're done, I think. Elijah, there we go, is to look at Elijah's situation after all of this. And what is it that we really learn from Elijah? And I think that when it comes down to it, I think we can identify with him maybe a little more than what we realize at the beginning. We got to begin with what happens, of course, on Mount Carmel and all the situation, the great showdown here. So if you don't know the story, and just as we won't read it all, but just to give you the cliff notes. So Elijah shows up on Mount Carmel, and he comes to the people, and he comes with thousands of people gathered to watch. We see the story of the prophets of Baal who show up, 450 of them, 450 of the prophets, or 400 of the prophets of Asherah. And the rules are each of us are going to bring our own animal, and we're going to build our own altar, and we're going to lay our own animals on our own altars, and you're going to call to your gods, and you're going to ask them to come and consume the sacrifice, and I'm going to call to my God, and I'm going to ask him to come and consume the sacrifice, and whosoever God answers the call essentially is the winner. And so essentially this is a my God is better than your God situation. And for the people, and this was something that, according to historical scholars, is something that was actually somewhat common. That a lot of times wars between nations were viewed as wars between deities, to say our God is going to lead us to victory against your God, and if we win, our God is the true God and yours is not. And essentially this is what you have, is a battle between deities. And of course, in Elijah's case, between the true God and the God of the Canaanite people. And so Elijah, of course, lets them go first. The prophets of Baal come and they begin to call to their God, and nothing happens. And they call for hours and hours and nothing happens. And Elijah begins to mock them and say maybe he's gone to take a nap, maybe he's busy, you know, he's probably not here, you should try calling again. And they begin to cut themselves and they begin to do all the things to try to get the gods of Baal, or to the Baals to come and to take the sacrifice, and nothing, of course, ever happens. Elijah comes and, of course, raises the stakes by saying, here's the animal, now I want you to dig a trench, I want you to pour water and more water and more water and more water, and so that everything is soaking wet and so that the trench is full of water, and then I'm going to call to my God. And, of course, he calls on God, and God shows up in mighty power. And he shows up and the sacrifice is consumed. And then it begins to move down, and then the altar is consumed, and it moves down into the earth, and all the water is drained up, and the earth begins to be consumed. And God shows up for Elijah and for the people in this great and mighty power. And that's what we end up with by the end of the story. And so someone has suggested that the key to understanding chapter 19, which is where we're going to read in just a minute, is found in the end of chapter 18. So at the end of chapter 18, in verse 46, we're told after all of this happens, they go, Ahab goes back to Jezreel. And in verse 46, we are told the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he gathered up his garment, and he ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. We missed the part about the drought ending and the rain coming and everything. So God shows himself in mighty power. Elijah calls back and the rain returns. And then we're told he goes back to Jezreel. What's important to know is that apparently Jezreel had been some sort of a makeshift capital where Ahab and Jezebel had been living, and they both went there, and that's where they were. And Elijah essentially shows up at Jezreel, the implication being to sort of proclaim the victory, right? His motive was, of course, to bring Israel back to God. We find out while they're on the mountain, the people were there, and they bowed down and said, yes, your God really is the true God. And so the implication sort of is either Ahab and Jezebel are going to repent, and the nation is going to come back to serving God, and the people of Israel are going to turn, or maybe when we get there, we're going to go to Jezreel and there'll be an uprising and we're going to overthrow Ahab and Jezebel, and the people have declared that God is God, and so everything is going to be fine again, and we're going to get the nation turned back around. But he gets to Jezreel, and we find out when he gets there what happens. Well, of course, nothing happens. Because when he shows up, it's business as usual. It's as if nothing happened, except Jezebel hears the story of what happens on Mount Carmel. And her word is, I hope that I will die tomorrow, by this time tomorrow, if I've not taken your life. So there's obviously no repentance by Jezebel nor Ahab. The people don't seem to be doing anything about it either. And so what does Elijah do? Well, let's read together and find out what happens, and this is where we can start to ask ourselves, what do we learn from Elijah? Chapter 19, start in verse 3. This is after Jezebel makes her proclamation. We're told, then Elijah was afraid, and he arose and he ran for his life, and he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and there he left his servants. And then he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and he came and he sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take my life away from me. I am no better than my fathers. And so he lay down and he slept under a broom tree. We can stop right there. What is the question that you have to ask if you're just reading it for what it is? You say, wait a minute. He just stood on Mount Carmel. God showed up and consumed everything in sight. The people immediately said, our gods are not worthy. And then all the prophets were killed, or the prophets of Baal. One woman says, I hope that we'll take your life tomorrow. And Elijah panics, and he runs, and he gets out of town, and he goes, and he just begins to just panic. Many people, and it's easy to just scratch your head and say, this makes no sense. The prophet who has defied Ahab all of these years and has stood up to him all of these times and has defied Jezebel and stands to the prophets of Baal and all of this amazing power that he brings from God, and then he gets a death threat from the woman whom he's defied all of these times, and then he leaves. And it's easy to say, what in the world? This makes no sense. And so this sort of mysterious, inexplicable event, and how is it that we see this such amazing swing of emotions and of confidence and all of these things? But again, you have to remember what happens after the showdown. He goes to Jezreel to proclaim his victory and to bring the nation back to God, and nothing happens. What do you do? What is it? Put yourself in Elijah's shoes. If you have just shown the people of God the most amazing power, and you have just brought this unbelievable display of might and these great mighty acts from God in heaven, and nobody listens, and nothing happens. What happens is Elijah sees himself as a failure. and he doesn't understand what to do. And so he's shown them all of this. This was his shot, and he has fallen on his face, maybe in his own mind. And so he packs his bags, and he leaves. Now, it has to be said that this is not, when you read it in the narrative, it's easy to just say, well, the showdown was in the morning and in the afternoon, and then things happened, and they went back to Jezreel, and, you know, the people didn't listen, and so he packed his bags, and he headed over, you know, went down the road to Beersheba. Beersheba is 150 miles away from Jezreel. So this is not just a discouraging afternoon. He goes all the way to Beersheba, and when he gets there, what does he do? Do you remember? He shows up and essentially begins to lay off the staff because he leaves his servants and says, essentially, your services aren't needed anymore. Go ahead. And he leaves them in Beersheba, and then he goes off into the wilderness and shows up to God and says, it's over. I've tried my best, done all I can do. Just take my life. I'm done. And he's giving up. He's leaving the ministry, and he's leaving the prophetic ministry, and he's failed. He had a shot. He did everything he could, and nothing happens. Now, if you're Elijah in this situation, how do you think Elijah answers the question? How long are you going to falter between these two things? Either God is God and you follow him, or he's not and you don't. Where is Elijah on the continuum now? You see the irony of the two things? Of the man who is the strong and powerful prophet who then is in the lowest of lows and doesn't know what to do, doesn't know what to say, doesn't understand what's going on. Well, you have to ask yourself, and I guess one preacher has suggested that this was so discouraging because it didn't really, this whole scenario is discouraging to Elijah because it didn't really fit into his plan. Because he had taken God and put him in a box and said, I'm going to do this, and the people are going to follow and listen to this, because obviously God's power is shown, and so this is what's going to happen. And when things don't quite work out the way Elijah thinks they're supposed to work out, he doesn't know what to do. Because he has boxed God into his own idea of what God is and who God is and what he can do. And so when it doesn't work out, he's lost. So what is it that we learn from Elijah? We learn that this is real life. That this happens. That you and I have been in the same position. That you and I have stood. I don't think anybody's calling down fire from God, but we've all been in that position where we have been on the high and we think we understand. And we're in a spiritual state where we're depending on God, and we think that we figured it out. We know what it's like to be truly committed to Him. We don't have to. Nobody has to ask us that question, because we're not following that other. We're following God. And when things don't go according to the plan that we have set out in our mind, or if God works in ways that we don't necessarily understand, then we've all been in the position, because it's human nature. Because coming to faith in God includes the ups and the downs. And it includes the not understanding. And coming to the answer of saying, God is God and I'm following Him, is not always as easy as we make it out to be intellectually. Because we can all step back and say, well, sure, God is God. But practically, when it comes to what I'm going to be, who I'm going to be, and how I'm going to live, it's difficult sometimes to come to that answer. And Elijah is a great example of that. Okay, so we can learn from the people that we all find ourselves torn a little bit. And we can learn from Elijah that this is real life, that ups and downs are part of life, and that being caught up in these things are part of our existence. Coming to faith means experiencing these things and doubting and trying to come to grips with these answers. It's a long process to answer that question. What do we learn from God? I think there's an amazing amount of stuff to learn from God in this one little narrative. It's a beautiful picture. Right away, when Elijah shows up in the wilderness of outside Beersheba, and he goes out and he asks, it's enough, Lord, take away my life. I'm no better than my fathers. Read with me verse 5. Go down to about verse 8. Verse 5. We're told that he lays down and sleeps under a broom tree, and behold, an angel touches him. And the angel said to him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones, and there was a jar of water. And he ate, and he drank, and then he lay down again. And then the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him. And he said, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you. And so he arose, and he ate, and he drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. What do we learn from God? I think we learn, first and foremost, that when His people are in the position that Elijah's in, that God provides the necessities that are needed at the time. And it's a beautiful picture because God does not come, the angel of course comes, but God sends an angel and he simply wakes him up and says, hey, come and get something to eat. He cooks him a meal. He cooks him something. He doesn't rebuke him. He doesn't lash out and just insult him for having some problem. He doesn't lecture him. He doesn't do anything like that. He simply needs a good meal. He needs somebody to reach out and touch him. It's important that the angel does that twice. Reaches out and touches Elijah. He needs nearness to someone. He needs rest, and he needs some time to be alone. And before God does anything to tell Elijah about what's going on, this is what he does. He wakes him up and says, have something to eat. And then it goes on further. I'll keep reading with me. Verse 9. There he came to a cave, and he lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he said, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I am only left. And they seek my life to take it away. God provides. Then he listens. There's a lot we can learn about personal interactions with people dealing with troubles from God here. God just brings him something to eat and then just listens to Elijah vent. Because essentially Elijah is blaming him here, right? He's saying, I have devoted myself to you. I have followed you. I have been zealous for you. I have given all to those people and nobody listens. Essentially the question is, where were you? You gave all of that great power, didn't help. And he's lashing out. It reminds me of Job. When we talk about Job, the great patient, you know, this image of Job being the tender and patient. You know, if you read the book of Job, and I think Barney is teaching it in his adult class, you find out really quickly that this kind and gentle, precious image of patient Job is not reality, because Job lashes out at God and says, where are you? You're not helping me. And things that would make us shudder to say to God. And Elijah's doing the same thing. And God just listens. We could learn a lot about how to handle relationships with people by God. And so we learn from God that He provides and that He listens. And He sends Elijah on to Mount Horeb. Do you know the name Mount Horeb, correct? It's familiar to you, but you know that it's not just any old mountain. Horeb is another name. You probably know it as Mount Sinai. This is the same mountain. It's interesting that he goes up and he gets into a cave in the same way that Moses got up and went into the Mount of God in a cave. And God is going to pass by him and show him his glory in the same way that he showed Moses the glory, the same way, in a very similar way. But he sends him up to Mount Sinai. After he listens, he says, go on up, stand on the mountain before the Lord. And then we're told in verse 11, about halfway down, behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after that, the wind, after the wind, was an earthquake. but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, there was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, there was a sound of a low whisper. If you read your old versions of that good old, the still, small voice. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and he went out and he stood at the entrance of the cave. And guess what he says? He says the same thing. Now remember, I want to point out to you, he says this the first time in outside of Beersheba. He says it the second time in Mount Sinai, another 150 miles away. So this again, this is not an afternoon trip down to Mount Sinai so that God can straighten him out. This is a 300-mile journey in round, in total, in which Elijah is trying to figure things out. And he gives the same thing to God again. And he says in verse 15, and all the same idea again, right? I'm the only one left. God says, what are you doing? I'm the only one left. They killed the prophets. I'm the only one left. They seek my life. They're going to take it away. What in the world is going on here? Well, it's just a lot to think about. Remember what Elijah had expected back at the showdown up on Mount Carmel in this great show of power and might. He expected things to happen that turned out not to happen, right? The great powerful display didn't change Israel at all. And so God brings him up on the Mount of God, up to Mount Horeb, and he brings them up and he shows them again some more amazing displays of power. And he shows up in the wind that breaks the mountain, but God is not in the wind. And then in the earthquake, but God is not in the earthquake. And then in the fire, but God is not in the fire. And then he shows up in the still, small voice, this low whisper. What's the only thing that brings Elijah out of the cave? If you notice, he doesn't. God tells him, go out and stand on the mountain. But Elijah never does. He stays in the cave until he hears the voice of God. And then he wraps his face in his cloak and he walks out on to the mountain and then he has this conversation with God. God wants to remind him that the voice of God, the Word of God, this is what changes hearts. This is what brings people to follow Him. Great displays of power are one thing. And it's not to say that God did not come in these ways. God came in the wind. You know, he took Enoch back to heaven in a great whirlwind. God came to the people in an earthquake. God has come to people in fire. What was it that led the people through the wilderness? It was God in a fire, right? All of these things, God shows himself through his power. But yet, he says those things, essentially, maybe what he says is those things have their place. What really brings people to commitment to me is to listen to my voice, to come out and hear what I have to say. And so, what God does, he says, here, listen to me. I want you to go out, and I want you, and if you continue reading, we won't read it, but he goes out, and I want you to appoint Hazael the king in Syria, and I want you to go and appoint Jehu as the king, and I want you to go appoint Elisha to follow in your footsteps, and I want you to do these things. And by the way, there's 7,000 other people, 7,000 people that have not named them, that have not worshipped Baal. God comes out with his voice and says, this is what brings people to me. Those mighty acts are one thing. Those mighty acts are what, and we can learn from those things. But God says, Elijah, listen to my voice. Listen to what I have to say. These are the things that move people to follow me. Hear what I have to say. Just a beautiful image. What do we learn from the people? Well, we learn that the struggle between these two opposing forces is ones that we face often. What do we learn from Elijah? Well, we learn that coming to the answer to answer that question is not always as clear as we would hope, and it has more valleys than maybe we would like. And we have to own up to that and realize that we're not going to be perfect, and that we've got to follow through to answer that question. What do we learn from God? Well, we learn that the Lord is there to hold our hand along the way and to help us and to help hold our hand and bring us to that kind of faith which challenges us to really devote ourselves so that we won't falter between those two opinions, but that we have a God to say, let me help you along the way. I hope it's giving something to think about. How long will you falter between two opinions? We hope that we're not at this present moment standing in the middle. If you are, learn from Elijah that there's a way out of that and that there's a God who will hold your hand and bring you out of that. We want to invite you, if you're in a position tonight where you need someone to hold your hand and help you along the way, our God can do it, and you have a wonderful group of people here that will be able to do it along with you. If you have a need tonight, would you come to the front while we stand and sing?